Hi there, my name's Oisin Dunne and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, we are speaking to Michelle Weiss-Maslin, the Emmy-winning number one hit music producer, music arranger, songwriter and music publisher who composes music and lyrics and produces and arranges for artists and films and TV and ads and promos and games and so much more. Now, Michelle has had numerous hit songs and cuts all over the world, as well as over 6,000 music placements. And so these are where her music has been synchronized in almost all music genres. So you will hear her music on radio and television every day. That is 7 days a week, 365 days a year, my friends. She has been awarded the SheSaidSo.com Alternative Power 100 Award and the First Impact Award at the Springboard Music Conference. It is such an honor to have you join us on the podcast. Welcome, Michelle Weiss-Maslin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. So you have been writing songs for most of your life, I think it's fair to say. But I'm really curious, what inspired you to start? And is it the same thing that inspires you now?
Okay, what inspired me to start, I think, is the same thing that inspires everyone who writes songs, poetry, music. Someone broke our hearts. Heartbreak, right? Well, I started writing before I was a teenager, but you know, once we become teenagers, everybody's breaking our hearts right and left. And we have this desperate need to be an open book and reveal all our dirty laundry and write songs about it. So that's basically what propelled me then. But I started out as a singer, and I started out singing when I was 2 years old. I mean, I always wanted to sing and I always wanted to make music and have never wanted to do anything else. So I started young, and so many of us do, right? When you interview people, don't you find that?
Absolutely. I love the fact that you've been singing since you were two and genuinely writing songs almost all of your life. But was there a point in your trajectory where you met somebody who really took you under their wing and just, you know, transformed your life by showing you how things were done?
Yes, but I was quite advanced in years by then. So it happened later in life. Not later, but I mean, I was close to 30 and Nile Rodgers mentored me. Yes, Nile, I can't give you enough credit to for how much he helped me, opened his heart and his studio to me. He did not have to do that. So I am grateful for that. Yes, for sure. And then, of course, before then, there were teachers and school people. But professionally, that was who it was. And it was in 1987. And so I had been doing it a long time before this happened. And I finally had someone who I really could pay attention to, emulate, learn from in such a big way.
Phenomenal. Nile Rodgers, a G-O-A-T, if ever there was one. And I love the fact that he was very generous with his support and he spotted your talent and really kind of helped you get to the next level. But I'm imagining this doesn't sound like an overnight success. You put in many, many decades of incredibly hard and tenacious work in order to get to this point. Did you have to learn to deal with rejection and keep going? How did that factor in?
Yes. So I had been doing it as a professional for not that long when I met Nile. It was 1979. So it was 8 years, 8 or 9 years. I guess that's a pretty nice haul. And before then, of course, in school, I had a band and like everyone, and I played gigs and played in clubs and things of that nature. And then I went to college for 10 seconds and I joined a band in where I went to college in Tucson, Arizona. I'm from New York City, so I moved to Tucson, Arizona to go to college. I joined a band. I left school. Nothing happened in school. And so I had been doing that and making money professionally because I played in a cover band and we made money. So then I came to LA and I was here knocking around for quite a long time. I was trying to figure out how to get a record deal in the early days.
Amazing. Amazing. That's great. And, you know, so you kind of put in the years, you had some really good breaks. You moved to LA and you really devoted your life into making this happen. But you have been so prolific. I downloaded a PDF from your website a few days ago, sweetersongs.com. We will link to it in the show notes. And there are pages and pages and pages and pages and pages of songwriting credits, production credits, engineering, the works. It's so impressive. It's incredible. And it's not just songs. It's videos, it's collaborations, there's video games in there. But I would like to come back to the central thing that you do so brilliantly and beautifully, is that you kind of create these amazing songs, they're released into the world. It seems like they have a life of their own once they're out there. What are some of the places that your songs have found a home?
They're your babies, right? And they go out there. And my songs have found a home in films and television shows that I'm so proud of. They haven't really found a home, though, per se. I found them a home. They've been on many major label artists. And I fell into situations because I was hustling. I would say that I have not been lucky. I would say I'm not the luckiest person. I have really worked so hard and I have sacrificed so much living to do this because I have had a dream and got them in all these movies. I'd find out about them. I'd question people, call people, read a Billboard magazine from cover to cover in the days when there were no computers. Now life is so much easier. But when I started, right, there were no computers. There were no fax machines. There weren't even cordless telephones. I mean, you know, the world was much different and you had to go to schmoozes and gigs and every day, every night, go to meetings, make phone calls, show up. You know, a lot of times if I had a song that I wanted to play to someone, I would just drive there. I would drive to the record companies and I would just show up and I would ask the receptionist, is this A&R guy there? I said, I'd love to see him if he'll see me. And a lot of times I'd get escorted back to their offices. And, you know, I was very determined and very tenacious in trying to get my music out there when I was an artist. And then when I morphed into being a writer, producer, and not an artist anymore, either way, I was still hustling and saying yes, because there were quite a few times where people asked me to do things I had no idea how to accomplish. I didn't make that kind of music. And I just said yes. And then, like you were alluding to before about the team and the collaborators, I would grab people and say, you do this, let's do this. I have an opportunity. And my main collaborator, I have now been working with for 44 years, and he is very talented in so many ways and directions as well. And we would study the music. We would listen. And we would, in those days, buy percussion instruments that might be apropos, buy instruments, you know, sonically pay attention to what does this genre require so that we can get this gig.
It seems like many aspects of songwriting are really timeless, but songwriting today is a fast-moving business. You've got new genres, new trends popping up all the time. How do you approach this balance between the timeless and the ephemeral?
Well, songwriting is timeless, but we have to stay current because things do change, styles, genres, sounds, things have changed and technology has brought along a lot of that change. So I believe we have to pay attention in addition to things being timeless. But I want to make timeless music. I want to not have my music dated. And that's difficult, right? Because it naturally gets dated, but I still feel a lot of them are timeless. And at this time of the world, my songs from the 1980s and 90s are having new homes, right? Because there's a resurgence of projects that are taking place in that time frame. So that makes them extra timeless because they're viable again. And that's very exciting. I didn't ever think that would happen, right? Like when I wrote a song in 1980 and produced it and recorded it, I never thought, oh, you know, 30 years or 40 years later, this is going to be viable again. I never thought about that. So that's been really fun. And that's why I'm so grateful that I learned how to make great productions back then so that they sound good. Because if I had just made chintzy demos, they would be useless.
Right, right. And is this something that you've always done, kind of make sure that your material that you're pitching is always to a kind of pro mastered standard? Has that always been something that you've done?
Always. Yes, always. And I'm not sure how I knew that. Do you know what I mean? Like thinking about it, because I've not thought about it much. I'm not really sure how I knew back then that they should sound that way. But it never occurred to me that they wouldn't sound that way. That was the mission in the recordings, was to make them sound professional. And I learned on the job for sure. You know, I didn't really know.
But like, you've always kind of kept on top of, you know, as much as your songwriting is absolutely timeless, it's classic songwriting, you know, but you've always kept up to date with genres, production techniques, you know, the equipment to use in the studio, the instrumentations, etc. But talk to us a bit about this changing external music landscape, if you like, the platforms, streaming platforms, opportunities there. What has this progression of technology meant for the craft of songwriting?
I think before all this technology, I'm sad to say, because I don't want to sound like this old reactionary person who can't change with the times, but you know, it was better then. The music was better. The creation was better. The care was better. Now we can make music so quickly, which I still don't do. It takes me, you know, it takes a few hours to write a song. I mean, it doesn't take that long to write the song, but to produce and arrange, mix, master, for me still takes 100 hours a song, sometimes less, sometimes more, but in that vicinity. Some people can produce a song and arrange it in 2 hours, in 20 minutes. Technology has changed a lot of this. A lot of it is cookie cutter, people throwing together loops and samples and beats, which I don't do because for synchronization, that's not allowed and not possible. But people do that, and they can just make songs very quickly. I like songs that are more organic. So I use electronic instruments in my songs for sure. But I use real instruments in my songs as well and make a combination. And if it's something like a folk genre or singer-songwriter or country, then I'm using predominantly real live players and musicians. So I think technology has changed that in terms of the recordings, that it's gotten a lot more virtual instruments. In terms of the listening, engaging, streaming, in terms of that, I will have to say that sadly, that is the death of the professional songwriter. Sadly, because there's no money to be made. It's very difficult right now for songwriters to survive. People like me will not have jobs. Eventually, I believe this professional songwriting profession will disappear. And of course, the artists will write their own songs. But the days of the glory of the songwriter are not long to be had. For Broadway, for musicals, yes. But for pop music, I don't see it, because it's not economically, financially viable, sadly, anymore, to do this job that we love and that we do. There's money to be made as a producer, yes, but many songwriters are not producers.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. That is some real talk. I mean, I've listened to a lot of your podcasts and seen you interviewed in a lot of places, and, you know, you do always tell it like it is. But that is very striking, that analogy. You know, is this to do with basically where royalties are going, where payments are going from the songwriting side of things on the streaming platforms? Is that where the difference is being made?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. Exactly. I mean, the streaming royalties, my royalty statement, which actually just came because it's royalty 31st royalty day. So we got our statements, the quarterlies, are the size of an old fashioned phone book, which young people maybe have never seen a phone book, but they're huge, my statements, right? All full of micro pennies. Hundreds and hundreds of pages of micro pennies. There wasn't even a micro penny on a statement maybe 10 years ago. Everything was in full dollars. Now there's decimal points everywhere. The amount, the streaming, the royalties have disintegrated. And this is not just for audio streaming. This is for video streaming too, like, you know, Hulu, Netflix, Amazon on demand, all the Roku and all the millions of streaming platforms and Spotify and for audio and Amazon and Apple and everybody. It's all the same. There's no platform that's paying much. In the old days as well, And old, by old days, I mean even 2 years ago, 3 years ago, you would have a song on, say, in a CBS television show or ABC or NBC, the networks, where you would make substantial thousands of dollars in royalties for an airing, and they would rerun and re-air. But now they still re-air, but they go to all these network streaming platforms. So they never re-air on the networks anymore. So you're only getting that one initial nice payment for royalties, and then that's it. And also the upfront fees have gone down. The sync master fees for the syncs, for placements. And in terms of the radio, yes, if you have the single, you can still make money on the radio. But if you have an album cut these days, there's no money. Whereas it used to be, if you had an album cut on an album that sold, you know, a million copies, even the song that was just on the album, you made substantial money. Now you make nothing, like nothing. Like you could make $100 if it's not the single. At the same point, there's money to be made if we diversify. We just have to diversify into so many different platforms, because I don't want to bring doom and gloom and say this is all bad. It's not all bad. I mean, it's just that we have to be more creative. It's not the old-fashioned world of have a song on a major label artist, have it on the album, make a bunch of money, have a single, make a bunch of money. It's just changed.
Yeah, it sounds like you have to be a lot more agile and resilient and flexible and you know, diversified, like you say. I mean, would you have any advice for folks who might be listening and thinking of getting into songwriting as a career based on the outlook that you've just shared there?
Yeah, well, you know, not everything is about money. So that's real. I mean, I like to make money, but not everything is about money. And we don't come into this just to make money. We come into it to show our souls, to share our souls, enlighten other people, have them enjoy the music. I mean, it's a village and we want to share that with the world, our music. And so there'll be a place for that. There are places for artists to do that. And I wouldn't discourage people to do that, but I would want them to understand it's not the world that it used to be, where the songwriters were making all the money and their publishing counterparts. Now we have to find other ways to make money. So maybe we have to do commissions where we don't own our songs anymore, where we're hired to and get paid up front to write songs for movies or TV shows or things like that, where we can get some money up front. And advertisements, where advertisements don't build our catalog because there's not much royalty going on with advertisements, but you know, they'll pay us up front a nice fee so we can afford to continue our journey and our craft and love of what we do. Trailers, the same thing. So we have to be able to diversify. And when I started out, writing songs for media was very low class. People who wrote jingles, people who wrote songs for TV shows, people who wrote songs for movies, nobody wanted to do that. They wanted to write songs for major label artists. So now we have to consider these other positions to diversify. Also, we can have music in retail stores, and there's money for that. And we can have music in libraries, and we can have music in micro sinks where they're used in a car wash, and they're used for a grandmother making a wedding video for her grandchild. And we have to learn to play around so that we can find the income that's available.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I had a really enjoyable chat on a previous series of the Audio Talks podcast with an incredible lady called Suzanne Chani. She is one of the preeminent electronic music composers, of all time. An incredible woman. And she explained how she leveraged her understanding of the advertising world and advertising royalties to fund her incredibly ambitious artistic projects in electronic music, in a way like doing the Coke ad paid for her to do these incredible electronic albums that have just, redefined what it meant at the time. But you mentioned how important it is for songwriters there to be diversified, to be looking for different opportunities. How important do you think it is for these creative souls to also understand the business side of things and to understand things like marketing and music rights?
I personally think it's imperative. I teach courses on the subject, lecture on the subject. I beg the songwriters to learn about the business because I do not believe that is optimum to go about making music without understanding music publishing, without understanding, yes, the business. It is imperative. If you don't understand what a writer's share is and a publisher's share is, this is bad. And most songwriters don't. And I find that is why I can navigate the business very well, is because I know music publishing just like a publisher. I publish my own catalog and I stay up on the current events of what is going on because every day things are changing. Every day there are new platforms. Is that a lot of work? Yes. And do the creators really sometimes want to go there? No. But it's a business, right? It's not music art. It's music business that we're all existing in. So it's such an important point you bring up that the songwriters and musicians and artists need to understand their business, especially now, because now is a time of DIY, right? In the old days, right? And old days meaning not 10 years ago, meaning like, let's say 30, 40 years ago, right? Even maybe 20 years ago, you either got a record deal and got a publishing deal or one or the other, or you quit. There was no real way to sustain being an artist, being a songwriter without the major system involved. Very difficult. You could be in a cover band. You could play wedding bands. You could do that kind of thing. Yeah. But in terms of operating in the big music world, you had to be involved and have a publishing deal or a record deal. Now, that is not as necessary, especially in publishing. I still believe in the major label record system. I think that if you look at the major artists around, everybody signed. There's only like one artist, Chance the Rapper, who's very successful, who has no major label ties. Everybody is signed. So I'm a big proponent of major label record deal if you want to be a quote unquote famous, massive artist. But you could be a massive, major songwriter and not have a publishing deal. And I'm also a big proponent of the writers owning their own publishing and knowing the business. That way, they have a chance to diversify and make money and not have their songs encumbered So when I was signed to the major publishers, I found my songs were getting encumbered. It was very difficult to pitch them for diverse sync, especially opportunities. It depends what, you know, what one is looking for, but one should always be educated. I was always educated. Yes.
That is such great advice, Michelle. Thank you so much. And I like that point that you make about, you know, if you own your own catalog, you have the freedom to do what you want with it. They're not encumbered by other contractual obligations that might get in the way of exactly what you want to do. But it sounds, you know, it's a very inspiring and informed example there, like how you've run things yourself, your understanding of the business, of rights, of opportunities. How much time would you say you spend on the business side of things, like networking and marketing, compared to how much time you spend writing and producing?
I spend much more time on the business side, much more time. And a lot of people don't want to do that. And I can understand that, but I love the business. I love the business side. So I encourage people to be open-minded and love the business side, because that will really propel them and help them be able to make good choices. For instance, signing a major publishing deal. If they're educated and understand what it's about, then they can well navigate it. Or deciding to own their own publishing and run their own company. I spend so much more time doing business. Yeah. And again, you know, that's a choice that people, a lot of creatives don't want to do.
Indeed. Well, I think in terms of seeing the impact of having that knowledge and that ownership of your own autonomy in terms of business and music business, just looking at that humongous list of credits. You know, anyone listening, please do check out Michelle's IMDb. It is being updated as we speak. The list is huge. So, you know, having that focus very much on the business, the networking, the organizational side of things, in addition to the creative work, it really does work. It's a great example. You know, your career is a shining example of having this kind of a very informed balance. But talk to us about collaborators. You mentioned it earlier. You've mentioned some great artistic and creative collaborators. But in terms of the business, are there folks like pluggers or libraries that you'd recommend that young songwriters should know about and they should reach out to?
Well, I do believe in diversifying. So that's a case of diversifying. I believe in using music libraries, but if they're non-exclusive. I only believe in using exclusive libraries if I'm commissioned. And then I'm thrilled, right? If they want to pay me to create a 10-song album or an EP or 20 songs or whatever, and they pay me for each song and pay the expenses and all of that, more partners in that, then I'm thrilled with exclusive libraries. But if it's my songs in my own catalog, then I want to work with non-exclusive libraries. And I do recommend people do that. I also love sync agents. They're fantastic. I love song pluggers. They're fantastic. But I want to work with them non-exclusively. I don't want to give my songs exclusively to one person or the other, because I like to pitch them as well. I totally believe in the team of that. I have been signed to major publishing deals, which really has been invaluable, because also in terms of education, I learned so much about how that system works. And I learned what I loved about it, what I didn't love about it, how to maneuver that world. So that's really great. I have sub-publishers in many different countries around the world, because I also believe in the global world, the global music business. Yeah, not just America. America is not the be-all, end-all, you know. So there's a whole world out there. And I've had local cuts with major label artists in so many countries. Like, you know, they're on Sony in Czechoslovakia and Warner Brothers in Hungary and the big, big artists that are, you know, that maybe in America we've never heard of, but they're huge in their own countries. And so I do that, and I have sub-publishers in many territories, which also help find the money, sometimes help connect some gigs. And that is also part of the system of branching out. I have collaborators all over the world, different people I've worked with, who I've written with, who are from all over. and have a different sensibility and are connected with different artists and companies. And I love to do that. And even though I'd spend more of the day doing business, I work a lot of hours. It's a long day. I believe in that. I work 17, 18 hours a day. Would I encourage other people to do that? I'm not sure. They would have to want to. It would have to be their passion. But do I think that some substantial long day is necessary? Yes. In this business, yes. It's not like, you know, working 9 to 5, and it's not school teacher, or even school teachers have homework all night. I mean, it's more of a job where you have to work a lot of hours.
Yeah, that's such solid advice. My goodness. And on one of the podcasts I really enjoyed listening to, The Entree Musician with Jerry B, it was so fascinating. It was heartwarming. It was inspiring. And one of the things that comes across, like, you know, crystal clear, is your incredible passion for what you do, your work ethic. You put in the hours. Now, you mentioned folks just coming into the business might find it easy to be, you know, put off by rejection. If there's a songwriter who's sending out a demo to like one or two people, they get rejected. They're kind of like, right, that's it. I'm not doing it anymore. You mentioned that you typically will send out a song pitch to thousands of your contacts. Talk to us about the importance of building up that network and the importance of breaking through the rejection and keeping going.
I feel that the rejection needs to fuel us. We can't be bogged down by rejection. I get rejected all day because I throw so much out there. So the amount of rejection that comes into my world is fascinating, because the more you put out there, the more you get rejected. And like you're saying, I do have people in my world who've quit after one or two rejections. I've saved every rejection letter I've ever gotten. Some now are in the computer digitally. Some are paper files. I have hundreds of thousands of rejection letters. I've always thought I should assemble them into a book and say, see, you can still become successful and get all of this rejection. And some of them are brutal. Some of them are so mean and just, wow, like you wonder what even possessed somebody to be so mean and write such a horrible thing. I don't even pay attention to it. My slogan is only the yeses matter. The noes don't matter. Yes, they don't matter at all. We just keep going. So I don't pay attention to the noes. They come all day. And every so often someone says yes. Right. But I will say that sometimes, you know, I really get to the point where I've been doing this right as a professional 44 years and plus all the years before then. You know, there are some days when I'm like, OK, I'm done. I'm going to quit. I've had enough. And then somebody says yes. And then I'm like, oh no, don't say yes. Now I have to keep doing this. Oh my God. Right. Just when I'm about to quit, just throw in the towel, just no more. Then someone says yes. So some gig shows up and some placement and some hit song and some something. And it's like so crazy. Tell everybody I mentor them, don't worry about the rejection. Just get excited by it. Just show them you're going to do it. You're going to show them it's going to happen. And when I had my first hit song was 1990, and I had been struggling for 11 years, and I had been pitching really hard, and I knew every A&R person in town, in New York, everywhere there were, and overseas. I knew everybody at this point already. They had rejected me constantly. And when I had this song, rather than anybody saying, you don't deserve it, you need to pay your dues, people were saying, oh my God, if anybody deserves it, she does, right? It was like almost like they were relieved for themselves, because they had rejected me so much that they felt better about themselves too, not just me. Something had finally happened. Like, they would all tell you, oh God, if anybody worked hard, she worked so hard for that, you know? And that felt good. Like, I wasn't angry. Like, some people could get angry and they would be saying, well, yeah, you didn't believe in me then. You know, you didn't even, but I'm showing you. No, I felt like I did it. I worked really hard. I owned this, but I was always grateful even that they listened. Grateful for the advice, grateful for anything. So I was never feeling angry with them for the rejection, but they really, people came out of the woodwork congratulating me. They were so happy.
That's lovely. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was it took a long time.
That's a long amount of years to be working away and getting rejected. But I love your mindset and the way you kind of embrace it, and just it fueled you forward. And then when the breakthrough came, it was all the more sweeter. And you had a great mindset to be on top of it in the right way.
Yes, and it hasn't been easier. So that's another myth that people think. People think, oh, if you just have a hit song, if you just get a cut, if you just get a placement, if you just get a theme song, everything is going to be easier. But the truth is, it's harder to sustain it than to even get that 11 years to get that first one. It's even harder to sustain it. And so one has to have a sense of themselves. One has to believe in themselves. One can't allow their whole being to be wrapped around this type of commercial success that's on paper. Who cares? One has to have a bigger sense of themselves, because if not, the business will eat them up and they need to do something else. That is hard, you know, and people always say, how do you do that? Well, I just do. I'm a happy girl. I've discovered how to be happy, how to feel good, right? And to believe and not let it get to me. Some days I stop. If too many people reject me in one day, I won't pitch songs anymore. I'll update my catalog. I'll do something else. You know, it just is not a good day. The stars aren't aligning. We'll do that. But I know too many people who their whole being is too wrapped up in this type of commercial success. And that is not healthy. It's not a way to live a nice life.
Yeah. Wise words there for sure. I mean, do you have any things that you do in terms of self-care? Do you have particular things that you do to unwind or to have that nice balance and perspective that you have?
I would have to say, honestly, I have no balance. I really don't. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm not very balanced in terms of that work-life thing. I'm a lot more work than life. But I was just on a holiday. I just went to Cuba. I mean, I do go places. I do things. I love to swim and hot tub. But when I go to the hot tub, I take the computer and work sitting in the hot tub. So, you know, in that sense, my balance is not very balanced. I would probably suggest people be more balanced than I am. But I have some ability to shake this stuff off. And sometimes, you know, just to get in the hot tub or the pool, I wash them all off. You know, all the ones who have been nasty all day, I just get in there and wash them off. And like, okay, you know, because as I was saying, people can be very cruel. They can be very mean. And my students, I warn them of that, you know, don't let it get to you, because some people, it makes them feel better just for some reason to be so mean. And I just wash it off, relax. But my relaxation is 2 minutes, you know, and then I'm back to work again.
I love it.
I'm not someone who meditates, you know, that doesn't excite me. I don't do yoga. I don't, none of that kind of thing. I'm like very type A New Yorker. That would make me insane to like sit there and like breathe. No, it's okay. I'll go back to work. I can do it.
You got the hot tub kind of,
I got the hot
you
tub.
Know, decompressed.
I sat in the hot tub all night last night and I worked. The computer, me and the computer in the hot tub. We were very happy.
Outstanding. Outstanding. And you mentioned there that, you know, you have students, you do share a lot of your knowledge. You are incredibly generous with your time, your expertise, with folks who want to reach out to you. Speaking of which, we will be linking to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. You've been very generous with your time with Audio Talks today. And, you know, I see you sharing a lot of great advice in a lot of very impactful places. Where can the folks listening find out more about the courses that you do? If they want to learn from you, where would they start?
The best way to start would be to contact me directly on LinkedIn. That would be the easiest. I always write back. If I don't write back, I don't see it, because I want people to write me back. So I always write back. And I have free videos on my YouTube channel where they can watch more interviews like this and get more advice and educational seminars I'm speaking at. So there's free advice, and they can also take my course. And once a month, I give a live Q&A where they can also come. And I often do song reviews where they can get their song review. So if they just write me on LinkedIn, yes, I'm on Facebook, but I have 5,000 friends. I can't keep adding Facebook friends, but LinkedIn is something I love, and actually an amazing platform for reaching out to people for business and getting gigs. I love LinkedIn. Well, we met on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is fantastic. So I do recommend that, and recommend them engaging with me if they'd like on LinkedIn. And if they want to hear my songs, my website has not been updated in forever. So it's not the most modern website, but I do have about 1,000 songs of mine up there. So there are songs they can listen to if they want to. They span from 1979 to present.
Wow. Incredible. It's an incredible catalog. It really is. It's so impressive. And I hope many of the folks listening will dive in. And I have one final question for you, which is something that we ask all of our VIP guests. And that is to choose a song for our Tidal playlist. And it can be 100% one of your own compositions or collaborations, just whatever you're feeling like recommending today for our lucky listeners.
Okay, sure. So it's very hard for me, right? Because between the songs that I own in my catalog and I have written on commission for other things, and Barbie and Mattel and everybody, that, I mean, there's thousands. So it's a little difficult to pick. So what I'm going to do is play the song that when someone asks at every meeting that I've ever gone to, they say, play me something that you've never had cut. Play me something that you love that no one ever likes. Play me the song that you think should be recorded. So that's the song I'm going to play. I wrote this song at a writing camp, a songwriting camp in Denmark, maybe 1990, maybe. And I wrote it with my dear friend Lottie Ogard, who runs a publishing company with her brother called TG Music in Denmark. And we were there for their writing camp. When we wrote this song, we all cried. We cried while we were writing it. It was so important to us, this song. And usually when I play it, a lot of the A&R people go, yeah, yeah, that's nice. What else do you have? So the viewers can be the judge, and even write me on LinkedIn and say, why do you think we get that response when to us, the song is so much our heart.
That is just wonderful. Thank you so much. Okay, dear listeners, we are going to wrap up the podcast with that very special track that we're going to play. And that is currently unreleased. You'll find it on your website, and we're going to play the show out with it right now. So my dear friends, all that remains for me to say is thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Thank you for your spirit, your soul, your heart, and all that brilliant advice and those great life stories. Thank you so much, Michelle Weiss-Maslin.
Thank you. Thank you, Ocean. It's a pleasure.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment, and share Audio Talks with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you are enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot, and it helps new listeners get to know about the stellar guests that we talk to in every single episode, like Michelle Weiss-Maslin. For more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. So, as promised, we're going to wrap up the show today with the song Last Day. It was performed by Nick Woodbridge and written by Michelle, Nick and Lottie Ergard. And it was co-produced with Joachim Hedslet Jorgensen. I'll see you next time.
Just want me, tell me when you're near. But sometimes all words are weapons and the light disappears. Still to give up this dream, watch it vanish in the air. Who would be more than one heart could live to lose and learn to bear? Ooh, with all these feelings coming out, I need to know without a doubt. Can you tell me that you'll be there when the darkness turns on me? Would you part the deepest ocean? 'Cause I want to believe that we'll walk this world together and ever after, you and me, until the last day. Wanna catch the dust of time slipping through my very hands. Every precious little moment written in sand. I would change eternity to keep you here with me. You're all the reason for me to be and why I breathe. Ooh, all I need to know and hear and say is all in all, yours in every way. Can you tell me that you'll be there when the darkness turns on me? Would you part the deepest ocean? 'Cause I want to believe that we'll walk this world together and ever after, you and me, until the last day. Until the last day. It's like I've loved you since the beginning of the beginning, and I couldn't love you more. Ooh, with all these feelings coming out, I need to know without a doubt. Can you tell me that you'll be there when the darkness turns on? Darkness follows me. Would you part the deepest ocean? 'Cause I want to believe.
Want to believe.
Never after you and me.
You
and
me.
Till the last day.